WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Daniel Okrent, was the first ombudsman at the New York Times. As the ombudsman, it was his job to represent readers of the newspaper who complained that certain articles were unfair or inaccurate, and to represent people who were written about and thought they weren't given a fair shake. In his column every other week, Okrent discussed readers' concerns, gave his own opinions, and included the responses of the editors and reporters in question. The ombudsman position was created by Bill Keller on his first day as executive editor. Keller replaced Howell Raines, who had been forced out after the Jason Blair scandal. Okrent agreed to hold the ombudsman position for 18 months, beginning in December 2003. His columns, reconsiderations, and a few retractions are collected in his new book, Public Editor No. 1. Now, the New York Times, a while ago, was referred to as the Gray Lady, but now it's kind of ground zero of the culture wars when it comes to the press. There are websites devoted to attacking the New York Times for its perceived liberal bias. Why do you think the New York Times has been at the center of the culture wars?
Well, I think that by common consent, it's the most important news medium in the English-speaking world, certainly the most important one in the U.S. It's the one that sets the agenda, really, for all other news organizations. If something appears on the front page of the New York Times, you are likely to see it on the front page of many other newspapers. You're likely to see it leading the evening news on television and radio as well. The Times has had this position for many, many years, and as the journalism business gets more fractured, I think that its dominance is even greater than it was in the past.
So what were the hot-button issues for the websites? Where if you wrote about this issue, you knew that the conservative websites that hate the Times would be buzzing about it?
Well, first, before going into the conservative websites, I want to say that the same thing happened with liberal websites, perhaps not quite as often, but with equal passion and at times vituperation. Everybody wants something from the Times. I think the conservatives want something different from what the liberals wanted. But everyone is watching all the time. The guaranteed hot-button issue was anything having to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There was not a word that appeared in the Times in my 18 months there, nor I'm sure in the year since, about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that wasn't poured over, combed over, chewed, swallowed, and then cause for response from anyone who cared about the issue. People care very deeply about that issue. Secondarily, I like to say that if you're thinking of becoming the public editor of the New York Times, don't do it during a presidential election campaign.
Thanks for the advice.
There wasn't a word about Kerry or about Bush that didn't undergo the same kind of full-body physical. And that was on a daily basis. So that if a picture on the front ran on the front page on one day showing a smiling, jubilant Bush looking confident, standing in front of a cheering crowd, then I would hear from Kerry voters, Kerry supporters, who said that the Times was clearly trying to do Bush's campaign's work for them. Now, they didn't notice or they weren't bothered by the fact that a similar picture of Kerry had appeared on the front page the day before.
Now, one of your most controversial pieces was headlined, "Is the New York Times a liberal newspaper?" Tell us what your answer to that question was.
Well, the first sentence of the piece was, of course it is. And if you ask me now whether it was a wise thing to write, I'd say, of course it wasn't. Not the position. I still believe that the Times then and the Times today is a reflection of the experience and worldview of the people who work there, and that on the social issues, and I stress the social issues, abortion, gay marriage, gun control, I do believe that a generally liberal attitude does get conveyed through the paper. Things are accepted as normative. That doesn't mean the paper, however, was politically liberal. I think that there is a difference. And the mistake that I made with that headline and the first line of the piece is that it made it very easy for critics of the paper on the right to excerpt those, not indicate the context, and use them for their own purposes. That's my own fault. Like everybody else who writes for a living, I want people to read what I write, and I think I went a little bit too much for the crowd's applause on that one.
You point out that a believer in creationism, their views would not be corroborated in Science Times, which is the weekly science supplement of the New York Times. So,
I don't think that's a bad thing. I'm not suggesting that it should be. I think that that sentence was simply an indication of how somebody who might believe in creation theory would come to the New York Times. I'm not suggesting that the Times should change anything that it does about evolution, because it believes, I believe, and I think it's factually proven that evolution is the way that we got to be who we are. What you are required to do is wonder, think about, and try to at least empathize with those who have a different view. How do they come to this view? Why do they believe this view? Do we need to represent that it is a fact, their view? No. Do we need to explain why they feel this way? I think we do.
When you use the word liberal and talk about creationism and evolution, is science now liberal? Is a scientific
No.
point of view not considered liberal?
No, I think if I were your ombudsman right now, I would say that you are unfairly conflating some of the things that appear in the same column. No, science is not liberal. I believe science is fact, and I believe that creationism is nonsense. And I don't think that one has to pay particular attention to nonsense. You have to pay attention to why people may believe nonsense, however.
Okay, now say the questions that I just asked you that you thought were going too far and that I was conflating two things. Say that was happening within the New York Times and you wanted to criticize me for it. Would you be sending me an email? What would you be doing to let me know that you thought I wasn't really doing a very good job there?
Generally, I would begin with an email. And I would ask you or perhaps your editor, I would point out what the problem was with what you had said, what you had written, and get your side of the story. And then I would be persuaded or not persuaded by your side of the story and then come to a conclusion the best that I could.
Now, if you had written me that email and then was awaiting my response, my first reaction would be like, oh, no, on top of all the deadlines, on top of all the work I have to do, now I have to write a response to the ombudsman.
Sounds like you've been working for the New York Times.
is that the kind of reaction you got all the time? Like, oh, well, all I need is more work.
that was one of the reactions. I also got the reaction, oh, this gives me the opportunity to explain myself to my critics. And I got the reaction, who the hell are you? And why don't you shut up and get out of my life? You know nothing about newspapering.
Right.
There are 1,200 journalists at the New York Times, and I think they had 1,200 different ways of dealing with me.
Now, it was during your tenure as ombudsman that Judith Miller was subpoenaed for refusing to name her source in the disclosure of Valerie Plame's identity, and she was subpoenaed even though she never actually wrote a story about that. She refused to disclose her source. She spent 85 days in prison, and then her lawyers worked out a deal with her source, and she ended up testifying, giving limited testimony. You first wrote in your ombudsman column, I believe that she is right to resist the subpoena. Her apparent willingness to go to jail to protect her sources is admirable, and the Times is right to defend her unflinchingly. You later wrote, Miller was not right to resist the prosecutor's subpoena to the extent that she did, and the Times' unflinching defense could have benefited from a flinch or two. What happened to change your mind?
Events unrolled. This is one of the nice things about being able to do a book, and I get to take back my mistakes and my misstatements. I didn't know the full story, and none of us knew the full story until the fall of 2005 when Miller went to jail and then came out of jail. I had not realized how little her editors knew about what she had done. And I was not aware at the time of the kind of alternative legal defense that might have been offered.
So, in retrospect now, what do you think the Times should have done when she refused to disclose her source?
Well, first, her editors should have known who her source was. Her editors should have known every detail about the conversation she had had with the source. They apparently did not, relying instead on the lawyers. This is what seems to be the case. That was, I think, an abrogation of the editor's responsibility. Beyond that, in terms of a legal strategy, you know, I really feel that when you use the First Amendment to protect yourself, the First Amendment is a wonderful thing. It doesn't mean that it often means that you run out of other arguments. I would have preferred, and I think now the Times would have preferred, to follow the policy that the Washington Post pursued when its reporters Glenn Kessler and Walter Pincus were similarly subpoenaed. Instead of bringing in a First Amendment lawyer with a First Amendment defense, they brought in criminal lawyers, and they were able to work out an arrangement that was satisfactory. Knowing what I do about those two reporters, Kessler and Pincus, I'm sure it's a deal that was one that protected sources They wouldn't do it any other way.
Now, you criticized the editors at the Times for not knowing who her sources were and therefore for not being able to make the best decision about how to handle the subpoena. There are new rules in effect, I believe, now at the Times for what editors need to know when an anonymous source is quoted. What are those rules now?
A responsible editor must know the name of the anonymous source for anything that's printed. If it isn't the editor who directly supervises the reporter involved, it moves up the chain until finally it gets to the executive editor, Bill Keller, and he needs to know. Now, even he has the privilege of saying, I'm going to give you a waiver on this one. He told me through my 18 months there that he had never used that one. And in fact, I think they've been much more careful about anonymous quotes because when a reporter is compelled to tell an editor who the source is, that will require the reporter to be much more careful and much more sparing in the use of such sources. So I think it's a very positive development.
The policy at the Times now is to explain why a source was given anonymity. What are some of the typical explanations that we read now in the Times?
Well, you know, I think they still have a way to go on that. The best ones will say something like, according to a congressional official who was opposed to the president's policy, according to an administration staff member who differs with the president's position on the issue or such. What I would like to see it say, according to a congressional staff member who couldn't be identified because his boss insists that only the boss's name get into print, or according to an administration staff member who wouldn't be identified because the administration would fire him if he were identified, and so on. I think that more candor could come into this, but they're moving in the right direction.
What do you think about this?
My favorite one is the one that says, and she was the source was granted anonymity because she didn't want her name in the newspaper.
There was actually an anonymous source explanation very similar to what you just described in a piece about clashes between the CIA and the Pentagon. It's that Senate aides who were granted anonymity because the discussions were confidential. What do you think of that as an explanation for
anonymity? I think it stinks. It's a shame. I know the reporter who wrote that piece. I think he's one of their finest reporters and a very, very ethical guy. And he slipped up and the desk slipped up and the top editor slipped up and the news desk slipped up that day. That's no explanation at all. That's the equivalent of saying he was granted anonymity because he didn't want his name in the newspaper.
I was wondering if, like, he wrote it that way because maybe he worked out a deal with the Senate aides that their reason for remaining anonymous had to be very neutral in order for them to grant the confidentiality in the first place.
Well, it's a bad deal. I also don't know what the quote, what it was that they were saying, which...
Oh, you mean like how important it was? And
yeah, right? Yeah. I think that there are two rules that I think that any journalist should apply to the use of anonymous sources. First, is there no other way of knowing this information, and is this information essential? If it's not, don't use an anonymous source.
My guest is Daniel Okrent, the former ombudsman at the New York Times. His new book is called Public Editor Number One. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Okrent. He was the New York Times' first ombudsman, and now he has a new book of his collected columns called Public Editor Number One. One of the things that you took on was the New York Times coverage of weapons of mass destruction, and you wrote to anyone who read the paper between September 2002 and June 2003 the impression that Saddam Hussein possessed or was acquiring a frightening arsenal of WMD seemed unmistakable. Judith Miller is the reporter who's been most criticized for the coverage in the Times that reported that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. What specifically would you argue that she did wrong in her reporting?
I think Miller's greatest error was becoming captive to her sources, primarily or largely Ahmed Chalabi, but there were various others. And that's a huge, huge journalistic crime. When you put things in the newspaper, not because you have fully vetted them and made certain they're true by checking against information from other people who may not have the same self-interest. When you go with somebody who says something because he has his own position to advance and present it without question, then you are not only captive to your sources, but you have imprisoned your readers as well.
You write about objectivity, and you point out papers have more analysis now. And you say some of the very best journalists in the country keep what they know off the page because they've been tied up by an imprecise definition of objectivity. How would you define objectivity, and what are some of those imprecise definitions that you're referring to?
Well, the idea of objectivity in journalism dates back to the first couple decades of the 20th century. And what it really meant, as put forward by people like Charles Mertz, who was an editor at the Times, Walter Lippmann, and a few others, was scientific method, that you go about your reporting by following certain procedures that are reproducible, so that if somebody else did the same thing, they would find out the same. That's objective, as it was first construed. What it then came to mean is fairness, and I think fairness and balance. Fairness is an absolute requirement in all journalism. Balance, however, gets to be misinterpreted. That gets back to what we were discussing before, that if you give the case for evolution, are you therefore required to give the case against evolution? No, because sometimes in the pursuit of balance, you get imbalance, because sometimes some things are absolutely true, and that doesn't require balance.
Let me give our listeners an example of a balancing statement that you didn't think worked. And this was in an article that was headlined, "Critics See Reagan Legacy Tainted by AIDS, Civil Rights, and Union Policies." And this was an article that pointed out the criticisms that were made of Reagan's acknowledgement and spending on AIDS. And it included this statement: "Gary Bauer, Reagan's domestic policy advisor for the last 2 years of his administration, countered that spending on AIDS research rose under Mr. Reagan." Now, what's wrong with this as a balancing statement?
Well, there was no spending on AIDS research before Mr. Reagan because there was no AIDS before Mr. Reagan. So it sounds like, oh, well, maybe Reagan wasn't so bad on this issue, or Reagan was good on this issue, when in fact it is absolutely irrelevant to it. And the reporters who included that in the piece, two of the finest reporters in the Washington Bureau, they knew afterward, when I pointed this out, that, oh, God, man, we shouldn't have run that comment, or if we ran that comment, we should have had a comment upon the comment. But that, you're on deadline. The man has just died. You're trying to put together the story that may show another side of things. And the paper failed. The reporters failed, the first level of editors, the second level of editors, the third set of editors. Someone along the way should have seen that this is false balance. This is actually what Bauer said, either a conscious deception or sheer nonsense.
Now, is this something you noticed yourself, or did a reader point this out to you?
I believe that was actually pointed out to me by another reporter at the Times, as I recall.
Anonymously?
Well, I'm certainly not going to tell you who it was.
No, but I mean, that's the kind of awkward thing. I'm sure, like, reporters who wanted to call attention to a mistake like that didn't really want to, like, hurt the reporter who they were criticizing. And they probably didn't want to mention that it was them who called attention to it either.
Well, you know, there's both a good and bad of that. The bad is that, yes, sometimes they might have wanted to hurt a reporter. It's a very competitive place. On the other hand, a lot of the people who came to me from the staff pointing out things that could have been better in the newspaper, things that were done wrong in the newspaper, cared desperately about the newspaper's quality. I think that was the primary motivator. When we do things wrong, maybe you can help us catch the mistakes, catch the missteps, and make certain that we do it better in the future. When one reporter at a newspaper makes a mistake and it becomes publicly known, that hurts every reporter at the newspaper. You know, the weapon that people came after me with from the day I got in that job, or came after the Times, was, you're the paper who gave us Jason Blair. And what Jason Blair did soiled the reputation of every one of the other 1,200 journalists who worked there.
Which leads to the question of morale. I don't know if that's anything you had to address in any way at the paper, but surely you probably observed morale while you were there. And, you know, you were there, it was after the Jason Blair scandal, Hal Raines resigned. There were a lot of really angry reporters who felt that Hal Raines had made things too competitive at the paper, and that I think for various reasons, many of which I probably don't know, that a lot of reporters didn't like the way Hal Raines managed the paper. And then there was the Times coverage of weapons of mass destruction. We later learned that those WMD weren't in Iraq. There was the way the Times handled the subpoena of Judith Miller. There were many things that were challenged inside and outside the paper. So what were some of your observations about morale at the paper, if you feel that's something that you could talk about?
Well, sure. First, I think morale at the Times historically is never terribly high. It's a very competitive place. It's filled with people, very, very smart people, very high accomplishment people, who find themselves in a ferocious competition to get onto page one. There are always editors to complain about. There's always ownership to complain about, the stock market to complain about. So there are all sorts of reasons to be unhappy, even when things are going great. Then when you add to it Jason Blair, Howell Raines, Judy Miller, and a variety of things related to those three names, yeah, morale can really take a beating. And I think that it's worth noting that when I wrote about weapons of mass destruction, I first had not intended to, because that reporting took place before I started in the job. I then decided that what was not in the newspaper, which is to say an explanation of the bad reporting that the paper had done, was part of my job. And one of the ways I reached that position is that many, many staff members encouraged me to write about it. Many people who worked at that paper were ashamed, embarrassed, chagrined over its huge failures during the walk-up to the beginning of the Iraq War. And they wanted these mistakes aired. And I thought that that was part of my job. So that do I think that my presence or my successor's presence as public editor, as they call the ombudsman at the Times, because the Times is more pretentious than other papers and has to have its own name for it, do I think that people in that position improve morale? Not necessarily, but you can go a long way to helping morale go forward if you do things that put the paper on the right track or on the track that the staff as a whole would like to see it on.
Well, Daniel Okrent, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Daniel Okrent was the first ombudsman at the New York Times. His columns and reconsiderations are collected in his new book, Public Editor No. 1. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.